In the Thick of It, a Profit and Loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Hello, welcome to In the Thick of It, the Profit and Loss weekly podcast where Colin Lambert and myself, Galen Stobbs, discuss some of the most interesting news items that have caught our eye in the past week in the world of FX. So to kick us off, Colin, I noticed, and I'm gonna be honest, I haven't read it yet. It's been a busy day, but I noticed that you were using your concerned face on the photo of your opinion piece this week. What are you concerned about, Colin?
It's not so much the concerned face this week, only it's the totally staggered and actually a little bit angry face in many ways. It's back to the, I mean, this week saw the filing of the documents in the Mark Johnson appeal case. And you sort of read through it, and the government seems to have, you know, the DOJ seems to have just like flipped 180 degrees on so many areas of the of their case. You know, for instance, there's a thing there now saying, well, okay, you did disclose that you were going to make money by pre-hedging it. Which was the central plank of their original case. So I'm thinking, well, how can you change your mind after a jury's convicted? And why are you actually defending the appeal if you think that actually the things that you convicted him on are actually, you know, no longer valid? But then it gets really bizarre, which I think is where my concern face comes in, because I think at one stage the government case now is that HSBC employees induced Cairn to pay the money after the trade was done, which kind of looks to me as though what they're saying is, well, you know, if you didn't like how the execution went, you can just withhold payment. Could you imagine the chaos in the industry if that happened? I mean, it may be slightly misread, and obviously these things are always spun to whatever side needs it. But I look at things like that, and then all of a sudden I've got the government saying, oh, you should have executed this in multiple tranches. Well, that's what they did. It's called pre-hedging. So now you're saying they should have done what they did, but that's what you call front running. And it's just really kind of strange to me that, you know, all of a sudden they've kind of gone 180 degrees in some of their calls, and they clearly have no understanding of how an OTC market works. And this, I think, is where my sort of irritation came in, because I'm looking at it now thinking, okay, we had these trade associations out there, and an ACI is, I have to keep on stressing, is an honorable exception, so he filed an amicus brief, but they sat there and did nothing. They kind of averted their gaze at a time when the industry is sitting there going, well, we need someone to explain to these people how this works, or someone, you know, with status and with credibility who's regularly engaged with the authorities in the US. And we got nothing.
So is this part of a broader problem, though? Because you know, I don't mind teasing it for our readers now, but we have a piece being published soon from that was penned, an opinion piece penned by one of the now infamous members of the so-called cartel, kind of making to some degree a similar argument in that the prosecutors fundamentally misunderstood how an OTC market operates. I know the details are very different, but do you just feel like that prosecutors have kind of waded into these cases without understanding the nuance of the structure of the market here?
Yeah, I'm becoming more convinced that what they're trying to do now is satisfy some sort of quota or missive from above saying we need to have a scalp for this. And they're trying to retrofit actions to different laws, because the cartel stuff is a little bit different to me, because there was an external sharing of information. Mm-hmm. For instance, in the Johnson case, though, they turn around and say, oh, we'll use code words and that proves that you're doing something illegal. And then they say, oh, yeah, but then you shared it internally. Well, yeah, but the reason they use code words is so that only the people to do with the trade knew what they were talking about. I use code words in the 80s. I've said this before on this podcast. You use code words if you don't want particularly a fairly gossipy sales desk to know what's going on, because you've got to protect the customer's interests. So it's just these contradictions. And it's like, oh, well, you know, now all of a sudden the DOJ is saying, well, it's okay for you to make some money on this, but you made too much money. How much is too much money? You know, I mean, Is it you know, a dollar? Is it $7 million? Whatever. I mean, it depends on how the market goes as well. And then all of a sudden they're saying, oh, well, why did you buy the bulk of the $2.25 billion in the last 10 minutes? That's ramping the market up. But the original case was, well, you shouldn't have bought any of it before the fixing. So now you're saying pre-hedging is okay, but it's not okay 10 minutes before, or is it okay 30 minutes before? And it's just a fundamental lack of understanding of how the markets work and I guess how liquidity works. I mean, it'd be interesting if the DOJ ever met the US Treasury, because I think the Treasury are quite concerned about liquidity levels in certain markets, you know, even US Treasuries. And if you suddenly look at these things where a market makes them, well, actually, I don't think I can make a price on this because I actually don't know how much money I'm going to make. I'm scared I might make too much money, or I'm scared I might pre-hedge. I'm scared I might pre-hedge 1 minute too early for you guys, and all of a sudden, I find myself, in this case, you know, facing jail. It's just, I just find it really strange. You know, I mean, at one stage, they even now try and say, oh, HSBC acted illegally because they sold 3% of the sterling to external parties. Well, that's called market making. You know, just when you've got an order, you do not stop your other activities. You can't. And frankly, if you want to stop the other activities, guess what? That's signaling risk 101. If I'm sitting there as a trader and I know that HSBC are always in the market, they're always making prices, and all of a sudden HSBC's stream disappears, something's going on. And the minute you know something's going on, you can find it. So, yeah, I think there is a fundamental lack of understanding, and this should have been dealt with a year and a half ago. And we should have had some of these associations like, you know, GFXA?
GFMA.
Then the AFME. They should have been in there. They've got senior people on these boards. They should have been in there saying to people, this is how markets work. This is why you have to do this. And they didn't. From what I can see, they did nothing about it. And unfortunately, we're now in a situation whereby if this conviction stands, we're now in the world of unknown. Well, how much are you allowed to make on the trade? How quickly can you pre-hedge? So, yeah, that was a reason for concern face yesterday. And as I understand it, I think the verbal arguments will be next, and then it will be 3 to 6 months for the judges to make a decision. Personally, I think the way looking at it now over the course of the last year, you kind of hope the same sort of outcome would happen as happened with the cartel. They'll go in there and go like, seriously, out of here. But we'll see. Moving on, I did want to sort of, you know, I'm kind of throwing you a bone here, I do admit. CTAs, I know you suddenly get all shivery whenever I mention it on the podcast, thanks to the absence of trend followers. But I noticed in last week's report, you put out a brief report on the Barclay Hedge CTA index, and currency funds were actually doing pretty well, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, especially compared to the rest of the industry. So for those who didn't read it, the Barclay Hedge, their main CTA index was down for 2018, so it was minus 2.85% for the year. But the currency traders index was up 5.1% for the year. I mean, pretty much everything was down except currency and discretionary traders. The cryptocurrency traders index had a horror show. That was down about 63%. Diversified traders was down 4.7. I mean, it was just like not a great look all round. So it was nice to see currency traders bucking that trend. And it's part of, I mean, I think last year was the first time in a number of years where, you know, volumes seemed to be up across the board. There was some volatility back between, you know, divergent monetary policies and Brexit and Trump and stock market moves. There was some activity there for people to actually sink their teeth into, and there seems to have been some performance on the back of it. That being said, and you know how much I love my CTAs, but there was a report, which I haven't finished writing up yet, from RCM Alternatives, kind of like a 2018 managed futures/global macro strategy review, kind of looking at which strategies did well and which ones didn't. So I'm just going to run you through very, very briefly how they ranked each strategy. Okay. Volatility traders, performance, very bad to very good. So basically some people killed it and the rest did terribly. Trend following, performance, poor.
No, I'm not having that. How can that not be a very bad?
Some apparently did. So the Société Générale trend index, which follows the ten largest trend followers, was down 8.11% in 2018. Its worst year on record. Yeah, how did this stock get worse than poor?
There is that too, yeah.
Okay, so they're being a little generous there. Agriculture was below average. Multi-strategy, good but not great. Short-term systematic, below average. Discretionary global macro, they've given mixed to poor. And then commodity and sector specialists, they've given poor. Although actually, did they notice again that some currency ones did pretty well? PE investments, for example, had their best year since 2014 with gains of over 14%. Mm. But one of the interesting things I thought about this report, looking at it more briefly, is kind of the role of CTA and managed futures. I'm just going to quote just one couple of sentences here. With equities getting hit hard, this was prime opportunity for CTAs, managed futures, and macro to come off the mat and show investors the power of diversification. Instead, the lesson was that sometimes non-correlation does not equal negative correlation, especially in the short term. So basically, this was CTA's time to shine. Equities doing terribly. This is why I keep you in the portfolio, managed futures. This is where you're going to smooth out my return curve. And that didn't happen. They just did badly as well. So an interesting point made later on is that actually they suggest that perhaps investors, well, they're saying that they're seeing more investors actually desiring tactical negative correlation. So basically something that's guaranteed to deliver when there is a sell-off, or not guaranteed, but that should deliver when there is a sell-off, in place of non-correlation, which I think is kind of an interesting trend and one that might bear watching.
Yeah, the only thing about that though is, I mean, I'm looking at it, I think, well, the only thing that strikes me that sort of kind of semi guarantees that protection when you sell off is short only, dedicated short bias, I think, is actually the official thing. And historically, they've done horribly because, you know, for 10 months of the year, the market just drifts higher and they just leak money and then they might make it all back in 1 month. I guess. The tactical piece comes in there saying, well, no, they'll time the moment of the dedicated short bias. But frankly, they can do that anyway. You know, they can just clear out of their positions if they see it coming.
As a staunch defender of CTAs, more because of stubbornness than any real belief at this point in time, I'm going to say that this is just investors just falling into the trap that the CTAs have laid for them. And RCA, this report agrees with me. This is another line, because they talk about investors souring on CTAs, and they said, we're all for that and a general souring on the managed future / macro space, because just when people are ready to throw in the towel on classical trend following or sophisticated multi-strat approach, this is exactly the point when that strategy will deliver. Boom. You heard it here first, Colin.
Yeah. And you know what? Actually, I would not disagree with that in any way, because I think you can see that in other walks of life as well. But, you know, I mean, I always used to joke that the banking industry was my barometer of when the market was going to turn in terms of, like, you know, investment and market structure. Because when it stopped investing in its platforms, that was the time when people, I think, was it 2013? Everyone said, oh, single dealer platform's dead. Guess what? All of a sudden, 2 years later, everyone's going, oh, I need my single dealer platform, I need my analytics, I need my data. That wouldn't surprise me. I guess, what is it, Churchill, was it? It's always darkest before the dawn. There's a bit of cultural reference for you there. There's one for the teenagers, Winston Churchill. On a broader note, I think this is quite interesting, though, because, so you said they're like, you know, discretionary traders did okay. Multi-strategy did okay. They're both flexible models. You're more flexible than the rigid, okay, I am, you know, agriculture, I am short, dedicated short bias, I am, you know, equity market neutral or whatever. So they're the ones, the guys with a little bit more freedom. And obviously currency traders to a degree have more freedom because, you know, they don't, unless they're overlay, they're not going to be sitting there, I'm dedicated long dollar. So the more discretionary strategies, you know, the guys with more flexibility did better. And I think that just reflects the markets now. And I think maybe this is something the CTA industry's got to think about, because effectively what we're saying is the market structure has changed to a degree that, you know, we're getting these mean reversions we're talking about. We're getting the odd flash move. We are getting a big move happening really quickly, and if you miss it, you're too late. But there's the more tactical guy, to go back to your tactive-negative correlation, which I'm still not sure I really understand what it means, but I'm not sure I'll work out how it's different to non-correlation, but these guys are the guys making the money. And I then would push this into the banking sector, where I think we may have mentioned it last week, but I've certainly written about it recently, about, you know, the FIC volumes in the major banks going down because customer volumes are lower. In other words, they're all brokers. Whereas there's clearly these numbers are showing, even on the negative side, there's opportunities. If you can lose 8% in a year, you can make 8% in a year. What you've got to do is actually get it right. So it strikes me that, you know, the people that are willing to actually put risk on and be flexible with how they put their risk on are making the money. The problem for a lot of the CTAs and hedge funds generally is investors really, really don't like style drift. And I kind of get the feeling that flexibility, it may not be style drift, but flexibility and the ability to actually, you know, turn off a strategy and put another one on is how you survive in these markets. I don't know. Well, I guess time will see. Is this making a prediction on the trend following this year?
I would say that is going to be one of my 2019 predictions, yes.
Excellent.
But we'll save that for another couple of weeks when it's published. What else do we want to talk about this week? Oh, one thing I want to talk about was there was some news from B2C2, which is an OTC. Yeah. We talked about crypto. It's an OTC crypto liquidity providers, and they've launched streaming, pricing, point-and-click execution on its OTC platform, so two-way pricing on its platform. That's all good and interesting. For me, the more interesting thing in that article was talking to one of the people at B2C2 who is – by background, an FX trader, kind of an algo quant type trader from the FX world, yeah, was that he was very much insistent on the parallels between the FX, traditional FX world, and how the OTC market is going to evolve, saying that, you know, now that there's all these exchanges, but eventually he sees that consolidating to kind of a few primary venues, and he ultimately sees it developing to an OTC market. Obviously, I guess, as an OTC provider, LP, talking in his own book somewhat there. But I thought that was interesting, you know, in a world where everybody's constantly like, oh, you know, everything's going towards kind of an equities exchange model. So here's someone say, actually, this market is, I see this definitely developing towards an OTC model. Any thoughts on that?
I think it has to. Yeah, I think it has to, because I think, generally speaking, it's the similarities with FX around the sort of, you know, geographical spread, the fact it is not, you know, not a centralized market. Nobody owns, you know, the crypto markets, I guess, beyond a few miners or the whales, as everyone likes to refer to them as well, in terms of the investors. But I think because, let's face it, if you try and actually put it in a regulated venue, if the regulations become too harsh or if a local regulator becomes a little bit too interesting, they'll just move somewhere else. It's kind of what happened in retail FX. You know, there's a bunch of firms walking around the world just going to the next jurisdiction that doesn't care as long as they pay a little bit of tax. So I think in many ways the OTC market is the structure for crypto because of that diversification of players, geographies, and to a degree the technology. Because I think, you know, the liquidity, it's a liquidity thing to the main. And you've got to be able to access the right liquidity. Now, yes, on exchanges, you can just plug into every exchange. The problem there becomes you end up with the same price. You end up with an MBBBO. A global BBO, if you can get it.
Yeah.
But then the latency comes into play. Latency comes into play, and it becomes a lot more difficult. So, yeah, I would tend to agree with them. I mean, the whole crypto space is still quite interesting, It's one of the few things I read about in markets. It just makes me laugh out loud sometimes. You know, 'cause like just this morning, I was sort of trolling through some my emails and you know, news sites, and I've had one guy say, "Oh, Bitcoin will be the next global reserve currency, and it will go to $10 million per Bitcoin." And then there's a bloke in Davos saying it's going to zero. We have a market. And when you have those divergent views and divergent reasons, yesterday or the day before, there was some guy saying, one of the crypto gurus, like the guy the other week who said it should be at 15,000 or 25,000 or something. Bitcoin's stable around 3,600, and that's building a base for a recovery. And I sort of had to point out on Twitter, it was very stable at $6,500, and everyone was talking about building a recovery, and then all of a sudden it disappeared $3,000. I think it disappeared 1,000 of that during our Singapore conference, didn't it, or during one of our panels?
It did literally during the panel. It disappeared quite a lot.
I think it's, to me, when you've got this sort of market structure building and the OTC market structure building, then to me, that becomes the preferred choice, because you've got to look for value somewhere. This is not just a question. It's not going to be like the Bitcoin of 2 years ago, where everyone just piles in and buys, and then every now and again you have like a $3,000 dip, and then everyone buys a dip. It's no longer a one-way street, and exchanges tend to lend themselves to one-way streets. The exchange structure. When you get the OTC structured, or when you get markets with a little bit less volatility and you've got to pick around the edges, then OTC is the only environment in which these people can make money. Because on the exchange, price efficiency means that you a lot of these strategies won't work, and volume goes down even further. So yeah, I would tend to agree with him on that one. Being the crypto expert I am.
Yeah, I think also part of it is just like when you look at the exchanges out there today. I mean, if we do see more institutional money come in, I mean, like what platforms are they really going to trade on? Like, this is assuming that you want access to spot and not just futures, because so many of the platforms out there were just kind of built online, and honestly, they get like a bit of volume and they just crack. Even some of the bigger ones, like the amount of emails that I've had from somewhere like Kraken being like, oh, sorry, experiencing a few technical problems at the moment, be right back. Like, you can't do that in a professional trading environment. So I think if we see more flow switching from retail to kind of more professional firms, professional money, I think that kind of only bolsters the case for an OTC market.
Yeah, and I think there's the interesting thing is, though, does that institutional money need more volatility? I don't mean does it need the market to be going up to 6,000 or down to 1,000. Does it just need to actually have a little bit more opportunity to trade during the day? Because at the moment, you could invest in a Bitcoin trading fund or become a Bitcoin trader. And frankly, you're not, given the spreads that are still out there. Yeah, we've spent, how long have we been around $3,600? It's been a few weeks now. And I wonder if that's still a hindrance to the institutional money. But I think you're right. When they do come in, it will become a survival of the fittest, and your technology will have to stand up to increased volumes. Futures, I don't know. The futures has been interesting, hasn't it? I thought futures would have actually taken over, but they haven't. So I wonder, does this mean is there an opportunity for one of the FX platforms? Yeah, what B2C2 is doing is interesting, because they're sort of reaching into the FX world to a degree, aren't they? But is there going to be a case where one of the major FX platforms goes, actually, you know what, we're going to take the leap here, and we're going to jump into these markets and provide an OTC venue that we know has got enough robust technology to handle spikes in volumes. It'll be an interesting one.
Certainly will be.
Probably a brave call for someone to make. And this is obviously a world in which everyone loves making brave calls. Oh, no, sorry, that's a different world, isn't it? on another note, I was quite interested in your piece on China. You attended a briefing this week China. About the sort of liberalisation of the RMB.
Yeah, I mean, it was more so BNP Paribas hosted a bunch of journalists for kind of a more broad overview on kind of China and China's economy. Obviously, we had some news come out literally this week about China's economy slowing down to, I think it was 6.4%, they're now saying?
Something like that last year, right?
Yeah, so it's slowed to 6.4%, which was about in line with what people thought. Now, there's two ways of looking at this. The first is that most countries in the world would kill for 6.4% GDP growth. That being said, Actually, a lot of the economists were talking about how when it comes to China, it's actually more important to look at the relative growth rather than the absolute growth. And from that, they're pointing at a slowing growth trend. And they were like, that's what's more significant than the actual number itself is the slowdown that we've seen. And there's three big concerns within China about this. The first being job loss, second being economic deflation, and third, you know, financial risk within a system that's slowing. So I thought that was interesting. I mean, on the foreign exchange side, on the currency side, they talked about that there's actually been a fundamental change in the policy stance within China, which was in the past they were saying there was one basically main policy stance regarding the renminbi, which was to promote the internationalization of the currency. As you know, when it went in the IMF SDR basket, they made a big fuss about that, and there was a lot of talk about you know, when the currency is going to internationalize more. And then that was very much kind of a driving force. What they were saying at the briefing was that for the past 5 years, at least, that has very much been the case. Now they're saying that the approach has changed, and that yes, they still want the currency to internationalize, but rather than using kind of government power, government intervention to really push for it, they're actually kind of taking a step back and allowing market forces to do that and push that. You know, for example, you know, more commodities and energy products, certainly in China and in kind of the APEC region, being priced in renminbi is one, you know, example of how the market will naturally do that for them, and letting the market do it, the heavy lifting, rather than the government itself really trying to push it. It was also interesting to hear them talk about the trade negotiations between the U.S. and China, considering. You know, I'm obviously not especially close to it here, but maybe I'm just affected by the negativity of politics here in general at the moment with the government shutdown. Mm. But they seemed like less worried than I would have expected them to be about the trade war, especially considering when they were asked what growth they're projecting with and without the trade war. So they said if the trade war gets concluded soon, they're projecting 6.2% growth for this year. That's with a trade deal. Without, they said it could get close to 5%. That's a pretty significant drop. And yet they didn't seem that worried. They were projecting end of February, early March, they expect there to be a trade deal, and they actually think that quite a lot of it is already agreed on various levels.
It's quite strange because, I mean, this is another instance where I think the markets are more optimistic than the man in the street, me included. You know, I'm not sure that there will be a trade deal this season as easily as they seem to think it will be in a few months. It's just like the day before. You know, you look at sterling, you know, up a couple of hundred points against dollar because they expect there will be some sort of Brexit deal. I mean, are they actually listening and observing who's involved in this? They've got much more faith in the politicians than I have, I have to say. I guess my point, the point I'd make on the China thing there about being market-led is I think the market could do that, but it probably needs more reliable and probably a better stream of data from the Chinese authorities. Some Chinese data, you know, comes out, you know, a little bit off kilter. You hear complaints about people saying, "Oh, you know, this is not, you know, they've revised this, and we don't actually believe this number."
And yeah, so I should have used the caveat.
I
should have used a caveat. Sorry, when they were making those projections about 6.2 with the trade deal and close to 5% without, that they did make the caveat. Oh, that's going by official numbers. And then someone said, what about unofficial numbers? And they were like, yeah, there's no real way to get those.
No. And I think that's maybe the problem with a market-led liberalisation, because the market will inevitably... And maybe the Chinese authorities, I mean, typically they tend to be cautious, and they play the long game much longer than people in the West do. So maybe they're saying, well, actually, the fact that the market's a little bit uncertain and will actually maybe tread carefully, actually suits them because it will be at a slower pace. The fear is that if the market does lead it and some of the numbers start becoming too volatile in terms of, you know, the picture they're painting, they could end up getting some unwanted volatility in their markets. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a slow, steady march, and it's going to be going on for many years to come in terms of China. But you can't ignore its influence. And frankly, I think sometimes the US tends to underestimate still the power of China and the influence of China in the global economy and global geopolitics for that matter as well. But that's definitely one for another day. I thought we'd just quickly close out actually, because it wouldn't be a podcast without something from the SNB. And I just noticed Swiss National Bank President Thomas Jordan has sort of turned around and said, oh, he doesn't foresee digital currencies throwing a spanner in the works for policy making, which is all very good. I think the headline was, he doesn't see a digital currency muscling out the franc. And that's probably because you're still sitting there on the bid trying to get out of your 20 billion euros that you bought. Sorry, in the Swiss bid, that would be, yeah. So there's our SMB slot for the week. That's it from us. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, have a very good weekend, everyone. Thanks for listening.